Hi, everybody. Aloha!
Aloha.
Oh, yeah. I'm Sterling Holmes. I'm an alcoholic. Through God's grace, this program is sponsorship. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since 2nd of June, 1981, and for that I am truly, truly, truly grateful. I want to thank the committee that finally got me here. It's taken 3 years. It took 3 years, three planes, let's see, a ride, a pontoon boat, and some dancing people, and poi, and everything else to get me where I'm at right now today. And I really feel blessed. If you have just gotten here this evening, you have missed it. Because it's been up till now, it's been like fantastic. I got here Thursday, and I attended a great meet. I went to a nice dinner and watched a beautiful sunset, attended a meeting Friday morning. I mean, I've just been surrounded with things that you guys do here all the time. And, you know, this is my first time in Hawaii, and I feel so blessed. I really, really feel so blessed. I'm so grateful to everybody that had anything to do with having me here. It's just been a wonderful, wonderful experience. And no, I've never taken a hula lesson. And to those of you that are new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know some of you, there's one up here. But don't worry about it, darling. They'll forget all about you come next year. Because there'll be a new one. But to any of y'all who are new, you do not have to move like that in order to stay sober, okay? Let me just quell that right now. But I want to thank all the speakers up to this point. It's been fantastic. I just love my New York couple. See, Willie thought Friday night that he was going to hear the same story. See, he didn't know there was another New York speaker that was on the ticket, see? So it was a little surprise for him. And then I got a little famous because they thought he was talking about me instead of Joe. And, you know, so I've been mistaken for Joe, and which makes sense. We look a lot alike. We could pass for brothers. I mean, you know. So, but it's nice seeing some East Coast sobriety. They brought a crew out, and I've been listening to the accent for like 3 straight days now. I'm homesick. I want a Kanish. You know. Oh, man, it's great. It is really great. I had to come all the way to Hawaii just to go back to my roots. It's great. It's fantastic. My full name is Sterling David Holmes III. Isn't that something? Now, when you have a Roman numeral at the end of your name, you're supposed to get a country to run. I looked outside. I saw a Kamehameha I and III and IV. You know, so when you got a Roman, you're supposed to get a country to run. So when I had a third at the end of mine, I was waiting for my country. And all I got was a little sister that moved into my room. So you talk about resentment. From the word go, I was born a weird little kid. I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I was really a strange kid. I was the kind of kid that needs sponsorship in kindergarten. Because when I got there, I felt different. I felt like there were two groups, me and all y'all. And it would have been nice to be able to drop a dime. At that time, I think it was a dime. I'm dating myself, but that's all right. You know, drop a dime and say, you know, I don't know. Maybe these people don't like me. What do I do? What do I do? You know, and he could have told me, eat the cookie, take the nap, you know. Because, see, that's what it's all about. I don't know how to, you know, it's, I don't know what kind of talk y'all going to get tonight. I really don't. But, because I know I'm looking towards a backache later on tonight. I've had poi. It's like my brain is going everywhere. But it's like alcoholics have a difficult time following instructions. Like, ever go to a meeting and try to see them make a circle in a square room? You know, we in my home group, my home group is a Foxhole group in Omaha, Nebraska. And, yeah, it's Shaka on a group, hey! I adapt. And at the Foxhall Group, after the Lord's Prayer, we ask that people put the tables, you know, the chairs up on the tables. And it's funny because when we stand up to get in, you'll see people putting the chairs on the table. We haven't even said the Lord's Prayer. It's just, that's just the way we are. We don't hear it the way people say it. So I can't blame none of the disease that I have on any of the stuff that happened in my life. Even though I grew up in New York, even though I went to Catholic school, even though I, you know, I had a family where my mom, you could look at me and tell my mom wasn't Donna Reed. You know, I heard from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, people really wanted to live that kind of lifestyle. And I wanted that kind of lifestyle. I've been to thousands of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have sat right next to people that have had Leave It to Beaver kind of lives. And they're just as screwed up in the head as I am. So it makes absolutely no difference what my environment was like. It makes absolutely no difference. Well, I could have grown up here or in the South Bronx where I did and grown up on the West Coast. It makes no difference whatsoever. What causes, what really triggers, what gets my alcoholism working is right between my ears. I see stuff with these eyes and I translate it with this brain and it comes out crap. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had it all figured out. Now, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you think you've got it all figured out and we're crazy, you are absolutely right. But the problem is, you're sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with a bunch of people that felt exactly the same way. And the ones that have been around here a long time with the white hair that stood up for the longest can tell you they know less now than they did when they walked in the door. That's what you have to look forward to. You have the rest of your life walking around with a confused look on your face. And if you don't put a trust in a power greater than you, what's going to end up happening, that confused look on your face is going to get you right back out that door and drinking. That's the thing. I had to surrender some stuff. I had to give some stuff up. Now, I was developing these old ideas as a kid. Like I said, I'm a product of Catholic school education all the way up to my first year of college. You know, and in the book they like to call, we like to call ourselves precocious. That's a nice way of saying asshole, I think. Because in the summer's day on the second grade in All Saints Church, All Saints Parochial School, I asked this nun, how can you have a virgin birth? And she was not prepared to discuss that profound theological concept with an 8-year-old. So she hit me and sent me to the principal. While I was sitting there waiting for the principal to come and hit me some more, I figured out that you grown-ups don't have all the answers. That started my alcoholism. See, because I listen to me a hell of a lot more than I listen to you. And my best thinking, the best stuff I had to bring to the table is what got me in here in a pitiful and incomprehensibly demoralized state. My best thinking. I did not get up in the morning deciding to wrap a car around a pole. I got up in the morning deciding on showing you how it was going to be done today because I thought I had it all together. I ended up drunk. I ended up angry, irritable, and discontented. I ended up pissed off at the world, and I ended up ashamed of myself. When I put that 7-7 down on that bar stool on the 2nd of June, 1981, I was a failure in every aspect of my life. And that's not how I planned it because I was only 24 years old. I started drinking at 13 on a summer's day in the South Bronx. A tall can of Colt 45. It worked. If y'all knew, I know you know what I'm talking about. If y'all old, I know you know what I'm talking about. The fact of the matter is, when I took that tall can back, it made me feel like I could speak as well as Jesse Jackson, play sports as well as Reggie Jackson, and dance as well as Michael Jackson. Now, regardless of what y'all seen tonight, that alcohol worked for me. And as long as it was working, I was going to work it. You know, and of course, I've heard this weekend, you know, if one works, 100 will work even better. And that's a fact. The thing about it is, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, when it stopped working that way for me, I couldn't stop working it. I suffer from an allergy of the body. Once I take it in, I'm going to want some more. And more important, I suffer from an obsession of the mind, which means that it's always going to be on my list. Drink is always going to be on my list. It was number one on the hit parade most of my life. And what I've been doing in Alcoholics Anonymous is dropping that thing down to like 10, 15, 20, 25, 35. Because if it's number one on the list, when something happens, either a great high or a great low, I'm going to go to the first thing on that list. And I got to drop it down. I got a lot of stuff to do because I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time. I got a lot of things on the list I can use instead of that drink. But if I stop doing that stuff, I go right back, comes right back up. It's cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient. It will wait me out. I'm convinced of that today. I wasn't convinced of that at 13 years old because it gave me the ability to do some things that I didn't really know how to do. Puberty is hard enough for the average human being. But, you know, you add a self-centered, selfish, all about me and self-consumed alcoholic, and I needed it. I needed it. We used to call it liquid courage in my old neighborhood, and I did a lot of courageous things while I was under the influence. Some of those things I'm not too proud of today. Some of the things that Joe was talking about. Some of the actions that I took in order to impress people I did not like and had no respect for. And I did stuff that I wouldn't normally have done. But I needed alcohol. It was a great tool. And because it was such an important tool, whenever I got in trouble with it, and I did from the very beginning, I would defend it. I remember one time I was trying to impress this young lady. And when you're trying to impress a brand new girlfriend, you always do something that you do well. So I challenged her ex-boyfriend to a drinking contest. We were drinking hot gin. See, I know, I'm in the right place. Hot, cheap gin at that. Out of bathroom Dixie cups, because we were poor folks, we didn't have shot glasses. So I won. I passed out. And it immediately went from a regular party to a slumber party. You know, everybody stayed over the night. I've always been progressive, you know, blazing a trail. Now, when I woke up, came to that morning, and found out what had happened, of course I was humiliated, I was embarrassed, I was mortified, and I blamed the whole experience on bad onion dip. Had to have been onion dip. Now, by a show of hands, how many people have ever been pulled over by a county Mountie for having one too many tacos? It is not allergic reaction to strawberry that gets us in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the ingestion of ethyl alcohol and all of the side effects thereof. That's what did it. But I had to defend that stuff because it was my solution. And it would be my solution for many, 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 many years. By the time I graduated out of high school, I was a full-blown alcoholic. Now, the thing about it is nobody in my neighborhood thought that an alcoholic looked like that. I heard what an alcoholic looked like this weekend, you know, with a long overcoat, the bag, and everything like that, puddle in front of him. We had one in my neighborhood. He had a little green monkey. He drank Mad Dog, and the monkey drank Mad Dog, too. Right? He'd get drunk, and the monkey would get drunk, but the monkey could stay awake and would guard him so that nothing would happen to him because the monkey make all this noise and try and bite you and stuff. And he was our town drunk. I mean, that was what an alcoholic looked like. I did not have a monkey when I got here. I can't possibly be an alcoholic. You know? So it didn't seem apparent that a 13, 14-year-old young man with a lot of talents and a lot of abilities that were apparent could be an alcoholic, even though I was using alcohol ridiculously badly. My mother was a narcotics officer. Yeah, made me real popular in the neighborhood, let me tell you. But she did something that was, I think, both wise and what people who have people like us in their family tend to do. The problem that people who have people like us in their family tend to do is they tend to care about them. And they tend to do things that will try to facilitate them being okay. And in the process of that, we take advantage of those folks and we hurt them. See, Mom had no idea that what she was telling her young alcoholic son, that it was okay for him to drink in the house, that she was enabling me. That wasn't enabling. What that was a mom being concerned about her young son, because it was a dangerous world out there in New York, and she didn't want her son getting into a situation that he couldn't control and might end up in tragedy. So she didn't mind that I did anything that I needed to do as long as I was safe at home. And that's what it was all about. That's what Mom was looking to do. And, you know, of course, I did whatever I was doing at home because I had the freedom to do that, and I also did it out in the street. You know, that was the way it was for me because it worked, because I got to be a big man about town. And, of course, I hurt her. I can only imagine what it felt like at 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and you got a 15-year-old son out there in the streets of New York, no earthly idea where he is at. And then you hear the key in the door, and he comes sliding down the hallway, and I'm hitting every part of the wall all the way down the hallway before I got to my bedroom. See, that's the kind of powerlessness that they deal with. That's the kind of fear that they deal with, and that's the kind of neuroses that they suffer from. And that's the kind of stuff that they have to recover from, just like I had to recover from walking down hallways like that. You know, Mom never saw me sober. You know, and I treated her really, 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 really badly. And I owe that woman my life in more ways than one. I owe that woman my life. And that was the way it was for me. I did things that were bizarre, and I did go to some good schools. I had some talents. They always told me I was never living up to my potential. I have never heard an alcoholic ever live up to their potential. My sponsor doesn't even think I'm living up to my potential. That hurts. You know? You know, but the deal is, that's just the way it was. And of course, I played all those games. And you know, the thing that always bothered me about growing up in New York is I never got a chance to join a game. I wanted to be a part of. I've always had a problem with being lonely and by myself and inside my own head. And I thought if I was in a gang, I'd be okay. So I was going to join a gang. But none of the guys, see, it was interesting in my neighborhood that if you had some talent, if you exhibited something that might get you out of the neighborhood, they would not allow you to get into the gang because that way you would go down and they weren't going to let you go down. It was better if you got out of the... So some of my friends who were in gangs would make it apparent to anybody that I couldn't get into one. Because I was going to get out because I could read and I could write and I could speak the King's English, you know, and that was what it was all about. And so I decided I'd join a big gang, the Department of Defense. I mean, you know, if you're going to join a gang's got nuclear weapons, you know. So that's what I did. I raised my right hand and I joined the Department of the Air Force. And, you know, on that day, they thought they were getting a reasonably sane, intelligent individual and they were going to train and send somewhere. And I thought I was going to get three squares and a cot, you know, three hots and a cot. And, you know, we both got into the contract not knowing that I was an alcoholic. They had no idea. I had no idea. Nobody in my family had any idea. I didn't look like an alcoholic. I was 20-something years old, didn't talk like an alcoholic. You know, I had no monkey. So, of course, they took me. And what they did was they provided an environment that made my alcoholism progress rapidly. And I think what it is, if you're going to do alcoholism right, you need to have an income, a place to crash, and at least three meals a day in the beginning. Now, the income doesn't have to be your own. Neither does the place to crash. And in the beginning, you do need three meals a day to sustain yourself. Towards the end, that's not a big a deal, you know. And that's what it was. So they had done that for everybody. They didn't pour Jack Daniels down my throat the day I enlisted. They just provided me with the same that they were providing everybody else. So I've heard at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous from veterans that they're talking about how they were enabled and everything like that. I don't know. That wasn't my experience. Because on every base that I was assigned at, there was a bar, but there was also a library. There was also a church. There was also a community center. I can't tell you where half of those other things are at. But I can tell you on every base I was at where the NCO club was. Because that's what I attracted to. That was my choice. And that was where I hung out at. And I bloomed. My alcoholism went crazy. I went to California and was underage drinking, acting like a complete fool. And, you know, I was getting into trouble. And I knew I was going to be getting into trouble if I continued the behavior that I was doing. And, you know, we get these moments of clarity throughout our drinking careers. And some of them become a little more severe as the longer we drink. And I realized that I knew I was going to have to make a change. And what I decided to do, as usual, whenever I feel like I have an inside problem, I always want to fix it with outside stuff. You know, and I'm chronically self-centered. And I have, like the book says, like the 12 and 12 says, an inability to form true partnerships. So, of course, the one thing that will make a chronically self-centered alcoholic happy is a relationship. See? I need to find somebody to help me love me, you know? And that's what it was. I mean, I found the object of my obsession, you know, locked on target acquisition, lock on load and, you know, pursue. And the thing is, alcoholics don't date. We hunt down and we capture. Now, a good hunter always goes for the wounded in the pack. Now, the thing about it is, the ones that we hang out with, the people that we come in contact with, sometimes they sense this danger. They sense something is very, very wrong. And they run. Al-Anons don't run all that fast. They keep us in eyesight, okay? There he is, okay, all right. Yeah. I love the program of Al-Anon. I truly, truly do. I am so grateful to Joan, and I heard some people this weekend mention that they've been in Alcoholics Anonymous some years, and this was the first time they had ever heard an Al-Anon speaker. I would highly, highly recommend, emphatically recommend, that you get a hold of some Al-Anon tapes, or when you hear an Al-Anon speaker is available, go to an Al-Anon meeting and listen, because you know, we sit in meetings and we talk about the pain and the suffering and we laugh about some of the bizarre behavior, but they have to survive it. They got to deal with it. And they love us in spite of some of our more abhorrent behavior. It takes a God to live with a drunk. Whether you be the drunk or whether you live with the drunk, it takes a God to live with the drunk. And I'm so grateful that Al-Anon is providing the people that love us unconditionally as best they can with a God that loves them unconditionally, so that we have partners in this thing called life. I mean, it's something that we don't deserve, and it's something that we should thank God above for, because without them, without my Al-Anon, I wouldn't be here today. I know that. So I'm very, very grateful to the program of Al-Anon. But y'all sick too. I had to do that for the drunks. I mean, I got to live with these guys. But I promised this woman the world. I was relentless. And she did not know that I suffered from alcoholism, and neither did I. And I fully intended on being a good husband and a good father. And I wanted all of that stuff. But I suffered from alcoholism. And alcoholism is, like it says in the book, a rapacious creditor. It takes everything. It will not allow you to be a good husband or a son or a dad or an employee or an employer or a doctor or a lawyer or an Indian chief. You can't do any of that stuff if you suffer from alcoholism, because alcoholism is most important. It's number one on the list. And that was the way it was going to be. Before we got married and she went overseas and I was to follow behind her soon after, in 1978, terrible accident took place. A car came out on the blind side of my mom as she was crossing in the middle of the block in New York, and it hit her and knocked her about 50 feet and put her in a coma. And in 2 weeks in 1978, she succumbed to that coma and she passed away. So I went home to bury my mom. And of course, I don't know about you, but I know alcoholics of our type, my type, we don't do guilt well. We feel bad about stuff. Joe was talking about that. And so, you know, I mean, we don't do guilt well. And so was Pat. Pat was talking about how we feel about things. And when I put my mother in the ground, I knew I was a rotten son. She had been nothing but good to me. You know, she was a very smart woman. Lost her Mobile, Alabama accent in Howard University. Taught me how to read before I started the first grade. You know, probably one of the smartest women I ever met. Mom had a small problem, though. Every once in a while on Saturday nights, I'd come home from out in the streets, and Mom would be laid out on the living room floor playing some of them old Marvin Gaye and Gladys Knight and the Pips and Otis Redding songs over and on the record player. It is 40. Oh, I'm sorry, for the benefit of the newcomers, 40 record player was a. It was like a CD player, except it was black and it was a little bit bigger, and we put a needle on it and it made music. Okay, that. But she would be. She'd be laid out, and I would turn that thing off, and I would send her, I'd put her in bed, and I'd say to myself, I'm never, ever going to be like that. And I never was. I mean, I passed out on the couch, and I played Earth, Wind, and Fire records, so it was completely different. But I had always, whenever I was in big, big trouble, I would always blame it on the fact that I grew up in the neighborhood that I did, that my mother and father got divorced, that my mother was the kind of person that she was, and she kind of abused me, and it was always her fault and all that good stuff like that. And now she wasn't around. She was in the ground, and I hadn't been able to make my amends. And that started the last 2 years of my crazy, insane drinking. I got sent overseas to Japan, and in Japan, they drive on the wrong side of the road. And there was times when I got so drunk, I couldn't remember what side of the road I was supposed to be on. So I drive right down the middle. Now, that's bizarre behavior for somebody 21, 22, 23 years old, up-and-coming young military man. And society reacts to us when we're doing our thing, don't they? They have all kinds of places for us to go. Most of them have locks on the outside, They have stuff for us to wear. Most of it has extra long sleeves and lots of belts. You know? That's what society likes to do with us when we're doing our thing. Because we scare the living daylights out of them. We drive on the road, highways and byways of America just so blasted we can't even see straight. And that makes people very, very nervous. And they decide that they're going to do something about it. And sometimes they infringe upon our rights in the process of doing something about it. And that's exactly what happened to me. I got to a point where my commander called me into his office and said, Sterling, we're going to do something about you. You know, and I'm already at the height of my defensiveness. And I'm ready for bear, you know. And he says, you're going to have to go into a local program. You're going to have to go into this 6-week deal. You're going to have to stop drinking and you're going to have to go into this deal. And I said, okay, you know, because I knew I was in trouble. So I went to this local program. And, you know, for 6 weeks, I had to go to group. Now, I don't know how many people have been to group. But in 6 weeks, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I had to go to group. And we sit around and group one another. And you drinking? Nope. You drinking? Nope. You drinking? Nope. In the group. Okay. That was the way it was. Because they didn't know much about this thing. They figured we were being honest. Monday through Friday, I was just, you know, I was giving up on drinking. So, you know, by this time, I'm 20-something years old. There's no way I could be addicted. So, Monday through Friday, I was just a joy to be around. You know that. Spreading warmth and sunshine everywhere I went. Friday would come along and I'd go into the NCO club to get some of that funny money to take my wife and family out to on the Japanese economy, going to have dinner. And I would go into that bar and I'd order a Coke because I wanted to see some of my friends. You know, these guys that were 30, look 50. You know, they were GIs, but they were doctors and lawyers and astronauts. And, you know, we were solving the world's problems at that bar. You know, and I'd go in there to say hello to them, and they'd be telling war stories and lies, and they'd be having drinks, and I'd have a Coke, and they'd have a beer, and I'd have another Coke, and then they'd have another beer, and I'd have a rum and Coke, and they start telling Vietnam stories, and I'd have another rum and Coke. I start telling Vietnam stories. I joined in 77. It was over. I remember one time I reported my car stolen and it was the only car in the NCO club parking lot at that time. And the club's got a bad sense of humor. When you can't find it, they won't let you drive it. So quite naturally, the commander knew that he was going to have to intensify my treatment. And he said to me, you have 2 weeks to decide to volunteer to go into, you know, inpatient treatment, or I'm going to send you by my order. And if you don't make it through, you're out of the Air Force. She was this close to throwing me out of the house and moving back, coming back. We were stationed in Japan. I've got a brand new little girl. You know, she was ready to get rid of me. So now the job is on my butt. The wife is on my butt. Everybody's against Sterling, you know. And I got 2 weeks to decide to go into inpatient treatment. Now, you know how long it took me to decide on whether or not to go. 2 weeks. Because we are the ultimate in egotistical. When the gun is to our head, we have to make the choice between life and death, between usefulness and happiness, between this program or dying in our own urine. We all take the time to make that decision. Okay, you're saying insanity or death or a lifetime of happiness and usefulness? Okay, is the death going to hurt? That's the way we are. That is the ultimate in ego. Ultimate in ego. We are the only group on the planet I think God has to deal with like that, you know? Everybody else has got a chronically disease. They want to go to a hospital and get it done. You know, didn't take care of. Whatever they got to do. Chemo treatments, whatever. All we got to do is read a book and call somebody. Show up a few hours a week, you know? Do some stuff. And we it's eradicated, but we can't even handle that, you know? I'm busy, you know? It took me 2 weeks, and I went down to treatment in the Philippines. There may be some GIs in here to kind of know, well, I'm in the part of the country where, yeah, I don't know about the Philippines, you know. The beer was a nickel. You know, yeah, see? You could go into town and explore every fantasy, demented or otherwise, with $10 and come home with change and a few communicable diseases, okay? This is where they sent me to get sober. It took them 35 days. I was talking to somebody who was out in this weekend who was talking about that. It was on the boat. Where is it? Yeah, there you are. We were talking about that. Voted most likely to drink 6 months. It would have been a landslide victory for yours truly if I had voted. It was 11 zip. There were 12 angry men in that group at that time when we all went together to treatment. It took them 37 days to teach me everything that I needed to know about alcoholism. It took all that information, all the Father Martin Chalk Talk movies and the Jelly Neck Chart of Recovery and Disease and all that stuff. They opened my head, put it all in there, and closed my head up, you know. I felt so sorry for you people when I was done. I did. I was willing to make a donation because y'all was sick folks. I didn't take none of that stuff personal because it didn't apply to me. So now I'm coming back to my unit and I know that I'm in trouble. I'm in the fishbowl and I know they're going to be watching me. And I went to a little meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because they required that of me. And I walked in this little room and I saw these people and the smile went from ear to ear. And they went, "Hi. How you doing? You want a cup of coffee? Yeah, we're going to have a meeting here." And so I'm like, "This is so-and-so, and this is so-and-so. How you doing?" "Hey, what's up?" They were happy. Happy to see me. Which pissed me off. How dare you be so damn happy? I'm not happy. You know, and I sat there and I listened to these people talk, and they were sharing their experience, strength, and hope about their disease. And it made me very worried because they were talking about stuff. They were telling stuff in public. You don't be telling people. You know, I've been to 15 treatment centers and wrapped 6 cars around poles. I meant, shh, man, don't say that, man. But they were so free and easy about themselves. And I'm looking around. I see these picture of these two old white guys up there on the wall. Another picture of these two white guys talking to this one guy on the bed. Got these little slogans around there. Got a beat up desk and a hammer. And, you know, I'm looking around. I go, "Oh, I know what this is. This is a cult. Y'all gonna try to jump me to Jesus. Okay, I got it now." See, because I knew all about God. I've been to 4 different colleges. Don't have a degree in any one of them, but I've been to 4 different ones. Know all about God. Got the Book of Mormon, got the Quran, had the both versions of the Bible. I quit being a Catholic well into my Catholic school career. Practiced Islam for a while. You know, as a matter of fact, it was a time when I joined this Baptist choir. Because it was this girl that was in this Baptist choir. And I wanted what she had, and I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. And the Baptist choir got loaned out to a Methodist church. So at any given Sunday, I was a failed Catholic who was a practicing Muslim singing in the Baptist choir in a Methodist church. I was the kind of drunk that with a 36-ounce bottle of Colt 45, I'd have an argument with a Jehovah's Witness and win. They would leave. And I was proud of that. So I knew all about God, and when y'all started with that prayer and ended with that prayer, I knew this was a cult. And I was waiting for the hard sell, you know, the lean. "Well, we have a building fund, and we need continuity, but you wouldn't let me contribute." And when you got in a circle and said that Lord's Prayer, some of you really meant it. And it made an impression on me. As always, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, this thing has probably made an impression on you. If you be like us, I know it has. I don't even have to assume. I know it's made an impression on you. I heard in my home group just last week, you know, "We'll screw up your drinking. If you be like us and you come here and you spend some time with us, we'll screw up your drinking. So you might as well quit. Because it's never going to be the same again. Sorry." You know? Better you hear it from me. You know? Because that was the way it was for me. I mean, you people had made an impact on me. I wasn't sure I trusted you, and I didn't know whether or not I really liked you. But you had something, and I found that attractive, and I hung out with you all. And, of course, you know, an AA group is cunning, baffling, and powerful. You know, they make you do stuff you don't want to do. It's been the key of this whole weekend has been talking about, you know, being available, being responsible, service. I got involved in service in the very beginning. They made me the coffee maker. They couldn't make me a chairperson. We had beat-up sofas. There was no chairs to set up, so, you know. The thing was, they made me the coffee maker and they gave me a key. And, you know, I showed up like 2 hours early for this 20-minute commitment, you know, because I'm thinking, I got the key. Drunks are going to die if I don't make the coffee. You know? So I'd get there and I'd get that big old thing of coffee and I figured there's 15 people coming to the meeting, so 15 of those old cap deals, you know? I was making espresso. I didn't know it, you know? To this day, I make bad coffee. I don't know if one of the members of the McClellan Thursday Night Group is here. I did see him earlier this weekend, but if he's here, he can attest to it. Many years later, I got to be the coffee maker in my home group in Sacramento, and it's still just as bad as it was back there at Misawa Air Base. I'm not any good at making coffee. And I love mochas, but I can't make them. So, you know, that's just the way it is. And they loved it. They just drank my coffee for two straight weeks, used a lot of cream, closed one eye as they did it, but they thanked me for my service work, and they, you know. Then they made me the chairman. That way I would have to show up at the meeting, you know, and talk about whatever was on my sick little mind, and they would 12-step me. And they held me together for a year, you know, and Joe was talking about, after about a year, they sent him a guy to work on, you know, as his final exam. And just at the time when my year was up, this guy walked in the door of the meeting and said, "Well, how do you know you're an alcoholic?" And you know, and all these people that have been real nice to me up to this point, all just sat there and looked at me, you know, and just went, "Well, tell him, Sterling," you know. I said, "I'm the new guy, you know. You guys got the experience, but they made me do it." And that it was a dialogue, and they just sat there and watched, and they shook their heads and they smiled, you know, cunning, baffling, and powerful. There was a big guy named George. George liked hugging folks. Now, I grew up in New York. You another man. You ain't hugging me. Sorry. George would chase me around a little room to hug me. And one day he caught me. And when he hugged me, I got hugged. And it felt great. I mean, it really felt great. I was starting to really like George's hugs. And now I was wondering, maybe I'm gay. Because, see, when you're new at Alcoholics Anonymous, I know you start thinking crazy thoughts, and you don't want to tell none of us about it. But let me tell you, you got to tell us, because you got a lot of more crazy thinking to do, so you might as well get rid of them real crazy ones. I entertain crazy thoughts while y'all have me up on that stage looking at that young lady, okay? Now, that's on tape. I know I'm responsible for that now. But That meeting took care of me. And inside, after about a year's sobriety, I came back to the States on fire about Alcoholics Anonymous. I loved it. I got involved in meetings. See, I've never given up a home group. I'm a member in good standing of the Misawa Air Base Japan group, a member in good standing of the Overtimers group at Peterson Air Force Base, Colorado. I'm a member in good standing of the Dedication group in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. I'm a member in good standing of the McClellan Thursday Night group in Sacramento, California. I'm a member in good standing of the Rantoul Family group in Rantoul, Illinois. And my present home group, which is the Foxhall group in Omaha, Nebraska. And I'm going to tell you, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether or not these are your home group. If you walk into your home group and the resident old timer sees you and goes, "Oh, Jesus." That's your home group. See, you got to be there long enough to be a burden to the people that have been there before you. If he hands you his phone number, he doesn't know you. You know, and that's not your home group. You got to make noise and get in the middle of it. And that's what I've done. And that doesn't mean I've done it right. The Dedication group in Florida made me the alternate GSR. Now, I knew how to spell it. You know, and then when somebody, I'd walk around, "Hey, I'm the alternate GSR." And they'd go, "Well, what does that mean?" I go, "Jim, you want to come over and explain to them?" I didn't know what I was doing. You know, they just gave me a title, you know. That was the way it was for me. And I'm going to tell you, if you've ever had a service job and you got a resentment now because they fired you, there's a reason for that. You're getting good at it. We like hiring the handicapped here. This is occupational therapy. You know what I'm saying? You get good at it, you start taking possession. You know? And nobody's in charge. You know, we live and die by a group conscience. Thank goodness for that. But I have gone to meetings. What has always saved my butt has been meetings. What has always saved my behind has been a regular attendance of meeting. I'd like to tell you the first 5 years of my sobriety was exceptional, outstanding. It wasn't, because I didn't have a sponsor. Bottom line, I was still using the group. And using the group as a sponsor can be a problem, especially if your home group is a discussion meeting, because you get to cafeteria-style AA. And unlike that wonderful buffet we had today, you know, if you pick the bad stuff, you may not just survive it. You just can't leave it on the plate. It might kill you. So I did not know that. And at 5 years of sobriety, I had a second pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I decided that I was either going to have to kill myself or get a sponsor. Equally tragic decisions as far as I was concerned. I decided to go for the more temporary of the two. I'll get a sponsor. I could always kill myself later. My God, with his higher, with his sense of humor, sent me to Omaha, Nebraska, which doesn't sound like AA Mecca, but it turned out to be, because I found some people. When I went down to this meeting downstairs in St. Mary's Church, I encountered some people that greeted me, just like Pat was talking about, greeted me. And they were smiles from ear to ear. Hi, how you doing? Hey, got a cup of coffee? How's it going? Woo-hoo! We're going to start the meeting in a little bit, you know, and just happy. Pissed me off. They had newcomers reading out of the book and stuff. You know, that's blasphemy. You can't have no six-month-old reading out of the big book of alcoholics. They don't even know what the hell they're reading yet. That wasn't nothing funny when I was 5 years sober and didn't have a sponsor. You know, I didn't have a sense of humor. You know, this thing was serious business, damn it. People live and die in this program. That was the kind of meetings I was hanging out with, where everybody was pissed off and grateful. You ever been those kind of meetings? Pissed off and grateful. I'm grateful to be here. I hug out of those. I've been around with people that have got enthusiasm, which means a God within, a spirit within. You know, they had something going. And what they had was structure in their lives, and they had solutions in their lives. And that gave them the freedom to be who they were. And they didn't give a damn about their look good, and they didn't give a damn about who knew what was going on, because it was small town AA. And one of the great things about small town AA is everybody knows your business. And one of the terrible things about small town AA is everybody knows your business. And that was the deal. I needed to get in the middle. I met a man that walked up to me, gave me a meeting schedule, and said, if you don't want to hide in Alcoholics Anonymous, here's the meetings that you should attend, and handed me that schedule. Now, that pissed me off. I took his inventory that day. I took his inventory the next day. I took his inventory the third day. Now, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. If you don't have a sponsor, and you got somebody inside your head for three straight days and they the same sex as you, get them for a sponsor. Might as well. If they're going to spend that much time in your head, they can do some cleaning up while they're up in there. I asked this man to be my sponsor, and he made me say please. It kind of pissed me off. Then to add insult to injury, he said, now if you're going to attend my home group, what you're going to do is you're going to put on a shirt and tie and a coat. And you're going to attend my meeting, because we have a lot of respect for our meeting and we have a lot of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're going to give respect, you should look like you're going to give respect. And that's what I'm asking you to do if I'm going to sponsor you. They're just too crazy for me. I'm just going to go back to them pissed off meetings I was okay in. And I'd get down the stairs and I'd shake all the hands, all the greeters, and I'd see some people and I'd shake some more hands. And by the time they started reading How It Works, I was in love with everybody. You know, and I was fine to be there. And they taught me some things. That man taught me a lot of stuff. He just didn't browbeat me with the book. He took me through the steps in a stern and impatient manner. He was consistent with me. But most important, he was an example to me. He did stuff, and he told me that he was doing stuff. It baffled me. He was willing. Whatever his sponsor said do, he did. He didn't question. He didn't bargain. He didn't do any of that stuff. And it just baffled me that a man this intelligent could be this submissive. But see, what I didn't understand was that he was putting his faith and trust in a power greater than himself, not this dude. He was putting his faith and trust in something that was more powerful than him, his sponsor, me, that whole group, the whole fellowship, the entire district, the entire area, the region, the world. He was putting his trust in a power greater than himself. And he was relying on that power manifesting itself in the direction that he was getting from his sponsor, because his sponsor had experience that he could rely on as being perfect and consistent. And I didn't see that, but he showed it to me. And he showed it to me on such a consistent basis, I discovered that that was exactly the same thing he was doing with me. My sponsor is not my friend. My sponsor is my lifeline to sanity, because I ain't never had a bad idea. Never. 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 Everything that comes up between these 6 inches is a good idea. And when I bounce it off him, I find out how stupid it is. I don't always like that, but I know he's told me the truth. He has never lied to me. Never lied to me.
And we've been together for like 15 years. I got sent. I was in the military. I was in the United States Air Force. And, you know, I remember at 10 years sober, I had the AA brass ring. I was cool. I mean, I got an award at the job. I've got the family. You know, yeah, she's not always speaking to me. Yeah, we're not in the big bed together because she's kind of pissed off at me. But, yeah, we're going to work it out, you know, because I got enough Al-Anon literature to be able to, you know, fix her. I know I can fix her. Because she's in captivity. I'm raising her and my daughter in captivity. You know what I mean? I got to fix them eventually. And I asked an all-important question to 10 years sober. Does she want to remain married to me? Never ask a question you don't already know the answer to. And she said no. And she left me and she took my daughter with her. And I was mortified. I was just, I felt like a failure as a man again. A failure, certainly as a failure as a husband and a father. And I would come to the meetings, and you know how we do pain when we don't, you know, we want all the attention but no help. You know, it's like, leave me alone, leave me alone. How come nobody's talking to me? You know, and I would come in there, and, you know, of course, my sponsor being the kind and gentle man that he is. And, yeah, he put his arm around me, and he said, you know, we're really blessed to have the only man ever to get a divorce in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not nice people. So I had to get over that and do an inventory on my relationship with other people. That's really fun, you know. Been kicked in the teeth, now you got to sit there and figure out why. And I found out I was a real asshole in relationships. And I had to subscribe to not do that again. And my God, with a sense of humor, put another woman in my life. He also gave me an opportunity to do some things. I was a weather forecaster in the military, and he gave me an opportunity to do television in that local market. So I was on television now going, hey, how you doing? Partly cloudy. Hi, you know. I got a little famous, and I got a relationship, I got a job, and I've got sobriety. I got the AA brass ring now. You know, I'm there. I'm just about to grab that ring. I got it all together. And the Air Force called up and said, go west, young man. I said, but you understand. And they said, go west, young man. So I went to Sacramento, California. And, of course, you know, because I'm self-centered and I'm chronically egotistical, I had to there must be a reason for this, you know. And I realized that there must be people dying by the thousands in Sacramento. I got a message for them. I'm going to get in my four-banger Nissan Stanza, and I'm going to come out of Reno and on I-80 and come into Sacramento and save everybody. See, because I wanted to make sure there was another picture up on that wall. See, you got Bill, Bob, Sterling. AA, the next generation, you know. I'll rewrite the book later. And the deal is, Cheyenne, Wyoming, the transmission fell out of that Nissan Stanza. I found three things in Cheyenne, Wyoming, a La Quinta Inn, an Amco station, and right at the end of Main Street, right next to the Pizza Hut, is this little hut, there's a little Quonset there, and it's the Alano Club. When I walked in there, picture them two old white guys. Guy named Jim, always a guy named Jim. The brown ashtrays, you know, the big orange brown ashtrays, yeah, you know. Beat up desk, always a beat up desk. And I stayed there for a couple of days, and I came into Sacramento during one of the worst rainy seasons in Sacramento's history, and I'm a weather forecaster. Without a car. Had to call, get rides. Now, Reggie had given me about three numbers for people to call that were active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm in this part of my story, I'm going to kind of breeze through, but I want to talk about what happens when you've been around a while. See, because I've been around a while. I had 10 or 11 years when I got out to Sacramento, California. I knew the deal. I had gone through the steps. I was sponsoring guys. I knew the song well and could sing it pretty good. But something happened when I got to Sacramento, California. I got scared. See, when you get scared, it all stops. I don't care how cool you were the day before. When you get scared, it stops. All activity, front or back, stops. And that's when drinking moves up on the list, when I stopped. And if it hadn't been for a guy calling me up to say goodbye because he was going to commit suicide, I died out there in Sacramento, California. This guy was full of it. He was playing a game, but what it did was it drew me right back into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I realized my life depends on my activity in this program. If I don't get in the middle of AA because I got a big mouth and like to be seen, I'm doomed. I'm doomed. Whether you think I'm doomed or not, it really isn't near as important. What I got to do is I got to get in the middle of AA and I got to be involved in stuff. Because if I'm not involved in stuff, it's going to move up on the list. And I got to Sacramento and I got involved. I used to go down to this meeting, the cathedral meeting. They would have a speaker every Saturday night. And I would help vacuum the carpet. And I didn't vacuum the carpet in my apartment, but I vacuumed the carpet in the cathedral meeting. I would shake hands with folks. I was going where I needed to go. And if they asked me to do something, I did it because I needed to get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got guys to sponsor. And I sponsored some really weird guys that had lots of problems, more than what I thought I had. And my sponsor loved it because I stopped calling him complaining and whining about my problems, and I started calling and complaining about theirs because I didn't know how to handle it. And I had to start to climb back in the big book because they were getting into an issue on whether or not they were an alcoholic. And I said, well, I mean, the solution's in the doctor's opinion from what I understand. Let's go through it. You know, and I don't know what I did for them, but I know what they did for me. I passed on principles that I knew worked in my life. And if they found them attractive, they practiced them. And I got to see the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. Getting in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous means that I put that drinking down on the list a little bit more. But more important, I get to see the miracle. I get to see what is just as beautiful as the little trip that John and I took earlier yesterday. I get to see the thing in Alcoholics Anonymous is just as gorgeous as that exhibition we had this evening. Just as graceful, just as wonderful, just as compelling, just as attractive. I get to see a human being that walks in here all screwed up, tore up from the floor up. If I pay attention, I get to watch right at the moment when that person realizes that they don't have to live like that anymore. If I'm paying attention, I get to see that person transformed right before my eyes. I get to see them clean up, grow up, and become what God intended them to be, if I'm paying attention. But if I'm grab-assing somewhere else, or if I'm doing something I'm not supposed to be doing, I'm going to miss the show. And that's what I learned in Sacramento, that I got to get in the middle so that I make sure I see whatever's supposed to save my behind that day. That I am right there present when God is showing me what I need to do in order to recover that day. Because if I miss it, it may move up on the list, and I ain't got another drunk back out there. I got another drunk. I just know I don't think I got another recovery. I got too much ego. I got guys that want to sponsor me if I go back out. And I'm not going to give them the satisfaction. So the thing is, I got to stay here. And that's what happened in Sacramento. I spent 5 years out there. I mean, twice. I had a big going away party for me because I was going to take another assignment to Korea. And they had a big surprise going away party for me, and it was a big pandemonium. My home group got together. I was even doing television out there. They said goodbye to me and all this. And then they canceled the assignment. I had to come back to Sacramento. Walked into my whole group. They said, yeah, you're making coffee again. Yeah. They didn't even miss me. You know, I mean, it was, and I did 2 years, and Roxanne and I got married, and I came back I retired out of the Air Force in California, and I came back to Omaha, Nebraska. Now, I know a lot of people wonder, what is a New Yorker doing in Omaha, Nebraska? What I'm doing in Omaha, Nebraska is the same thing you're doing here. I'm doing the deal. It's like any bar I've ever been in. I had some bars I loved hanging out in. I mean, they were nice to me. Where everybody knows your name. You know, that kind of thing. Okay, I hung up those bars, and there were other bars I just drank in. Well, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in Omaha is the place where I like to hang, just like my favorite bar. And I will go to a meeting anywhere, but that's the fellowship I craved, and it made sense that when I retired out of the Air Force, to go where I felt like I needed to grow, to go where I felt like I could be of most use, and that I could get the most benefit out of. And besides, I had married a girl there, so, you know what I mean? Makes sense, you know. And we embarked upon a life, and she had a 14-year-old son who liked rap music. And we had to learn how to live as a family, and we did. You know, there's a bunch of people in my family right now having their challenges. In my sponsorship family, a couple of guys that I sponsor, their parents are starting to wane, and they may not be long for this life. And my young son is having some problems with the law. And the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've come to know, we've got our share of sicknesses and problems. And of course, we don't even go into the world's problems that are taking place right now with our sons and daughters in a far-off land. And there's a lot of stuff that's going on in my life and in the lives of the people that I care about. And I have faith today. See, just like I saw all those beautiful fish and all the wonderful colors that I've been looking at since I've been here this weekend, I have faith that whoever orchestrated all of this beauty and grace and pageantry will also make it okay. Because I walked in the door here the 2nd of June, 1981, and I got that message from you that it's going to be okay. Just keep coming back. Keep showing up. And it'll be okay. We're going to work this thing out. Don't know how it's going to end, but we know it's going to be okay. You know, and I've got that faith today. I don't know what he's going to do. I don't know what's going to happen to their folks, but I have faith that it's going to be okay. Throughout all of my life, through the ups and downs, I've been shown that and told that time and time and time again by Alcoholics Anonymous that it's going to be okay. I just have to do a few things. Frank talked about it in the 12-step workshop this afternoon. There's certain things I just have to do if I want certain things to happen in my life. And I know what those things are. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous or you've even been around a while and you're scared and you're crazy and you're upset and you're angry, you're irritable and discontented, I'm happy for you. Because you're now at the point where you can do something that can change your life. You're now at the point where you can surrender. You can give something up. Make room. Because the only way I'm ever going to get God within, the enthusiasm that I need to live one day at a time, is by getting some of this other gunk outside of me. To make room. You teach me how to do that. Because you test my patience. You challenge me with the actions that you take. You embarrass me and shame me and kid me and make me laugh my way into serene living. And that's what it's all about. That's why we get along so well in here. Because we know how to get on each other's nerves. We know how to push the envelope. Nobody out there understands us the way we understand one another. There's a love here. And I've been seeing that love since I've been here. I've seen the love of God manifest itself in the environs and the fauna and the people and the colors and the shapes. And I've seen the love of God manifest itself in my family. And I've seen the love of God manifest itself in me, through me, to another human being when I've been about doing some service to them. I've seen it. I'm convinced. I know it's real. I know it's here. And it's present. And it's mine. All I got to do is make room. Get in the middle and make room. I've got a future. I don't know what it's going to be. But I know that it's going to be okay. If you hear nothing else tonight, realize that whatever you're going through, it's going to be okay. So long as you step in the middle. I'll close with a little story that I think defines what really is what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Guy was trying to paint his house. Had a 2-year-old helping him. Just like that little boy tonight, you know. He is so cute. He wasn't much help. Okay. So he decided, he saw a picture of the entire globe, all the continents and all the oceans, and he tore it up into pieces of paper and told this little girl to go into the next room and put this puzzle together. And expecting that he'd be able to get some stuff done, you know, while she worked this puzzle. And in 10 minutes she was back out, finished. And he was very impressed and was like, well, how did you do that so quickly? And she said, well, there was a man on the other side. I put the man together, the world came together. See, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of old ideas, problems, difficulties, you know, frustrations, anxieties, neuroses, and all of that. And you basically told me was all of those are very compelling problems, Sterling, and we understand that you want solutions for them. But before we get into all of that and try and tackling the world, why don't we just set those aside and give you a list of principles that we put up on the wall regularly that you can try to practice. Why don't we give you a God that loves you unconditionally? Why don't we give you a place where you can regularly attend and try to work out the problems and the situations of your life? And armed with the tools, and then we can send you back out in the world and see how you struggle and how you do it. I challenge anybody that's in Alcoholics Anonymous one day, 1 year, 140-something, to try it. I mean, to give it an honest try, to sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, make room, and give it a chance, you know, for whatever, 90 and 90, 200 and 200, you pick the number, it doesn't really matter. But give it an honest try, because if you do, I think what you'll find is that by being responsible to yourself and making room, you'll get the keys to the kingdom. I'm grateful to be here and sober. Thank you.
Hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.